Tortoise. Hello, I'm Claudia, and you're listening to the Slow Newscast from Tortoise. This is episode 2 of our 3-part series, Putin's Murders.
В 2006 году мы с Аней вместе сделали статью о трагическом событии.
In 2006, I and Anna wrote a news article about the tragedy that happened in Dagestan when 20 young males who were Chechens, who were ethnically Chechens, but it was in Dagestan, they were invited to talk about the future of Chechnya to the sea, to the seashore.
In a gentler world, Dagestan would be a tourist destination. It would lure visitors from all over the world to its orchards, its Caspian coastline, its bucolic villages, its mighty snow-capped mountains. In Putin's world, Dagestan is different. It's a hotbed of radicalism right next to Chechnya, and it's a staging area for the Russian army. The army's role in these parts hasn't changed much since the time of Leo Tolstoy. It is to assert control of the Caucasus, because they're a great natural frontier, and so that Muscovites can cavort in peace on the Black Sea Riviera. It is a bloody business. Svetlana Ganushkina, speaking through her translator, picks up the story of the 20 young Chechen men.
They were tricked. They put on military uniforms, all of them, and brought them to the border of Chechnya and Dagestan. I brought them to the border of Chechnya and Dagestan. And from the Chechen side, they were shot. All of them were killed except four. Four survived.
Svetlana Ganushkina is a Russian human rights activist, now in her 80s. The Anna she refers to is Anna Politkovskaya, one of the most celebrated Russian journalists of the post-Soviet period. Together, they produced an article about the 20 young Chechen men. It was researched by Svetlana, who interviewed 18 of the men's families. It was written by Anna, who refuted Russia's claim that they were terrorists. This was not the first time they worked together, but it was the last. Not long afterwards, Anna Politkovskaya was shot 4 times in her Moscow stairwell, including once in the head. A control shot, the mark of a professional hit.
And somebody decided to give this gift on the Putin's birthday, because she was murdered on the Putin's birthday.
October the 7th, 2006. I'm Giles Whittell. From Tortoise, this is the Slow Newscast. Putin's Murders, Episode 2. Follow the Money. Anna Politkovskaya reported on countless atrocities carried out by both sides in the war in Chechnya. She reported on the Beslan school siege of 2004, in which 186 children died. She reported on the apartment bombings of 1999, as evidence mounted that the FSB was behind them. She was warned often that she would pay with her life, and she carried on reporting.
And back then, during the Second Chechen War, even though it was still possible to speak freely in the rest of the country, it was not possible in Chechnya. And because of that, it was very difficult to work as journalist there. This process, we call it Chechenization of Russia, meaning degrading of civil liberties, right? It happened in Chechnya, and then it kind of captured the rest of the country.
The Chechenization of Russia may not mean much to outsiders, but there's something to it as a way of understanding why Putin has resorted so often to murder. During his first 2 terms in power, Chechnya was both problem and solution. It was a problem as a centrifugal force, a quasi-autonomous republic with a history of rebellion, not unlike neighbouring Dagestan, whose Islamist leaders wanted out of the Russian Federation. Putin argued that if he let them go, the whole country would unravel. But Chechnya became a source of solutions too. Putin found that by using his army and his air force to flatten its only city, Grozny, he could intimidate the whole place into submission. It worked in Syria too, and Ukraine. And then he could strut like a professional wrestler before his people, who, it turns out, like a bit of old-fashioned conquest. Here's Bill Browder, the financier who made a fortune in post-Soviet Russia before falling foul of Putin.
Well, in fact, if you look back further, in 2008, he was flagging in his opinion polls, and he took Georgia. And in year 2000, when nobody knew he existed, he started a war in Chechnya. Basically, every time he needs to be elevated and affirmed in a weird non-democratic system, he starts a war. And you just look at the opinion polls and look at the wars that he started, and it shoots right up after each one.
Finally, as a bonus, Putin could enlist loyal Chechens and use them as the most ruthless of enforcers, with complete deniability. For instance, 4 Chechens were charged with Anna Politkovskaya's murder and were put on trial. 5 people were eventually imprisoned, 8 years after the event. What evidence exists suggests the whole process was a smokescreen to hide the involvement of the FSB. I asked Svetlana Ganushkina if she believed Putin himself gave the order for Politkovskaya's murder.
I don't think he gave out an order.
А зачем?
Why?
Зачем вы это делаете?
Why would you do that?
Люди, которыми он себя окружил, ловят...
His inner circle, they kind of, they read the room. They understand what needs to be done without saying.
And so does the FSB itself. 6 weeks after Anna's death, the single most spectacular murder of Putin's tenure unfolded over 3 weeks in London.
I think really for the outside world, I think it, internally it happened earlier, but for the outside world it was the killing of Litvinenko, which really marks a shift.
Alexander Litvinenko had resigned from the FSB, fled to Britain, and written a book laying blame for the 1999 bombings at Putin's door. Misha Glenny, the McMafia author, says Litvinenko's slow poisoning with polonium-210 was a wake-up call for every government still clinging to the idea of trusting Putin. And the feeling was mutual.
He felt he was being disrespected by the West and that NATO was not being forthcoming enough in terms of meeting his anxieties and concerns about NATO.
2 FSB agents were identified as the poisoners. So who gave their orders? We may never know. The reading the room theory, subordinates keen to please their boss and to spare him the need to give explicit orders, well, that's still plausible. But a British public inquiry long afterwards concluded that Putin did, probably, personally approve the operation. And for what it's worth, Vladimir Milov, the former minister we heard from in episode 1, is in no doubt.
Well, I think that he's 100% personally responsible because his management style is associated with extreme level of micromanagement. Extreme level of micromanagement. He really inserts his nose into everything.
Milov tells a story from the previous year.
Some of my former government colleagues had to be appointed for a position of just the deputy chairman of department in Gazprom.
Gazprom is the Russian gas monopoly, a state within a state.
And in Gazprom, they have like 50 departments or whatever. And I saw him like 6 months later since I heard the rumors. And I say, are you appointed already? He said, not yet. And I said, why? He says, because this issue has to be agreed with the president. I said, wait a minute, Gazprom has no president, it has chairman of management board. He said, no, you didn't get it, the president of the country. Now, that level of decisions. And if you look across, I mean, you can't be micromanager in everything else and at the same time not know that plots to assassinate your political opponents are being planned and executed. This is just impossible, right?
That same micromanager took personal charge of preparations for the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014. The Games cost $50 billion, a record for any Olympics, winter or summer. Money couldn't fix the climate. Nor come to that, could plane loads of Himalayan salt flown in by a self-appointed snow expert to try and slow down the melting of the snow. One American snowboarder said it was like landing in mashed potatoes. But that $50 billion did make certain favored contractors in Putin's inner circle very rich. Two of his boyhood judo pals, Boris and Arkady Rotenberg, did especially well. The sums spent on lifts, roads, hotels, ice rinks, and a whole new airport for Sochi were staggering. Kind of. They were actually small compared with the overall sums embezzled and smuggled abroad over the past 24 years by Putin and those who've come to depend on him. Bill Browder puts the total at $1 trillion. And it's worth hearing him out on how he gets to that number. He starts with $230 million, which he says was lost to a government corruption scheme uncovered by his Moscow lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, in 2007. Magnitsky was killed trying to find out what happened to it. Or at least, he was jailed on a pretext, and he died in prison. Browder's people picked up Magnitsky's threads and followed them to wherever the money was parked.
And eventually we discovered there's one bank, a Danish bank, Danske Bank, through their Estonian branch, had laundered 200 of the $230 million.
They passed that information to a Danish newspaper, which compared it with more findings from a data dump on a much larger scheme that became known as the Russian Laundromat.
They came back about a week later and said, actually, the number is not 230 million. We've identified 8.3 billion that's been laundered through Danske Bank. And they wrote a big story about it.
That was the cue for much soul-searching at the bank and in Denmark generally, and for a big independent investigation involving external accountants and lawyers and data analysts.
And they come back 6 months later, and they make an announcement that it wasn't 8.3 billion, it was 232 billion of money was stolen and laundered through Danske Bank. So this is just one bank, one mid-sized Scandinavian bank, where we can lift the hood. So if we can lift the hood on Raiffeisen in Vienna, UBS and Credit Suisse in Zurich, Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt, and a few others, I believe the number would be closer to $1 trillion, which is, by the way, very consistent with the estimates of capital flight out of Russia during that time period. And so nobody can absolutely prove it's $1 trillion, but I think that's the right number.
Why is this relevant? Because, Bill Browder says, the people doing this laundering are ruthless.
If you try to get in the way of their corruption, they want to make sure you're dead.
In Bill Browder's view, this is what's missing from the Chechenization of Russia analysis. The money.
Money is worth more than human life to these people.
That may be a reasonable hypothesis, but is it true of Putin personally? The case of Boris Nemtsov may point to an answer.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge. Like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans. Life Underwater, a new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.
Boris Nemtsov was, for many years, a leading member of Russia's democratic opposition. He was handsome, he was brave, articulate, one of those people endlessly profiled by wishful thinkers in the Western media as a potential president of a better Russia. In 2013, he produced a detailed dossier on corruption in preparations for the Sochi Games. It was Boris Nemtsov who identified the Rotenberg brothers, Putin's chums, as the big beneficiaries. On February the 27th, 2015, he was walking across the Bolshoi Moskvoretsky Bridge directly opposite the Kremlin, in the snow, with his girlfriend, late at night. They'd come from a fancy cafe on Red Square, when he was shot and killed. Left on the street, his body half on and half off the pavement. Vladimir Milov says the fact that it happened so close to the Kremlin was significant for a technical reason.
This is an area of jurisdiction not of the city police, but of the Federal Guard Service that guards Kremlin as the major federal institution. They had refused to release any footage. I mean, if you just stand at this point and look around, you will be able to see how many people are surveying this spot and how many cameras are installed in the Kremlin walls and so ever. They failed and refused to release anything.
Footage did get out, though. Across the river, a security camera at the offices of a government-owned TV channel, TV Center, captured most of it, but not all. Very grainy pictures show the couple walking south and a man who must be the gunman approaching them from the opposite direction. As he passes them, a snowplow draws level and slows down. The moment of the shot is hidden. Then the snowplow moves on, the gunman runs a few meters to a getaway car, and Nemtsov's girlfriend, Anna Duritska, is left standing over his body. Those images were shown around the world. Putin condemned the killing. An investigation was promised. Five suspects were rounded up, all of them Chechen men. Three of them are still serving sentences, but who hired them has never been established. The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe alleged a cover-up, and Bellingcat, the open-source intelligence analysts, later reported that a specialist FSB assassination unit had been tailing Nemtsov for months. It looked like a new high watermark of Putinistic impunity. A brazen act, a parody of an investigation, a brutal underlying logic. Misha Glenny explains.
When it comes to the issue of murders, once he's broken the relationship with the European Union, NATO, and the West, it doesn't really matter to him. You know, no one is going to call him to account for what he does, and provided he supplies his immediate entourage, the broader elite, and a bulk of the Russian population, which is an atomized population, inexperienced in democracy, with a relatively decent standard of living, he feels in a position to do what he wants, including murdering people abroad, murdering people at home, throwing them in jail.
I asked Boris Bondarev, the former diplomat who resigned over the Ukraine invasion, why he thought Nemtsov was killed. Was he somehow a threat?
I mostly think that it is like, you know, like a fly buzzing around. And it cannot hurt you, really. Yeah, it cannot really do you significant harm. But with time, you just get too tired about this constant buzzing, and you just kill it.
On the subject of political killings generally, Boris Bondarev reckons Putin could survive in power quite easily without them.
But I think he wanted to show his power, his capacity to reach to anybody. Maybe. Because what's the point of being a dictator if you do not abuse your power, right?
Nemtsov was killed in 2015. By that time, Misha Glenny thinks Putin had long since lost any clear sense of a distinction between his own interests and those of the Russian state. It's a psychological disturbance, he says, common to leaders who stick around too long.
Several people have written very well about this, that it's after about 8 years in office that people in the top job start to believe in their own omniscience and omnipotence. And I think Putin, you know, who soon will have outlasted Stalin as the longest Russian leader in the modern period, started suffering from this for a long time ago.
If so, it must have surprised him when someone he thought he knew well launched a coup attempt in broad daylight on live TV one morning last year.
This was the guy who always wanted to show off. This was the guy who always wanted to prove his mettle.
His name was Yevgeny Prigozhin, and Yulia Latynina knew all about him. She blames him for a series of attacks on her, her friends, and her family in 2016, when she was a journalist for one of Russia's last remaining independent outlets.
I was working at this time for Echo of Moscow, so once upon a time I parked my car. Actually, I parked it quite far away from the building, precisely because I was very uncomfortable by this time. And there was a guy on a motorcycle, two guys on a motorcycle. They had a big jar of poop. They splashed it on my head. I was covered completely in it.
It was human, she thinks, though she admits she didn't check.
To tell the truth, I really felt relief the moment I realized it's the poop, because obviously, as I've said, if somebody dumps poop on your head, this means he doesn't want to kill you.
In the next few weeks, Yulia Latynina's parents' dacha was hosed down with a foul-smelling liquid of mysterious origin, and her car had its brakes sabotaged and was then torched.
I got their hint.
She left the country. She doesn't believe Prigozhin personally covered her in human excrement, but she does see his fingerprints on a broader intimidation campaign directed at that time at anyone daring to take on the Kremlin in the media.
This was one of the things he excelled about. Everybody could say, well, this is just Prigozhin. It's not the state. The possibility of denial.
Prigozhin famously moved on to bigger things. He had made millions from catering contracts with various arms of the Russian state, including the army. And part of that fortune he ploughed into his own army, the Wagner Group, which led Russia's capture of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine last May at catastrophic human cost. Prigozhin was so infuriated by the Russian military's failure to back him up in Ukraine that he turned on it. On the morning of June 23rd last year, he rolled into Rostov in southern Russia at the head of a short convoy and calmly informed the commanders of the very substantial army garrison there that he'd taken over. Then he set off up the M4 highway towards Moscow. Misha Glenny still shakes his head at the memory.
The lesson from Prigozhin is perfectly clear. If you are going to march on Moscow, you have to go the whole hog. What was really fascinating about Prigozhin is that very few units of the militarized Russian state were willing or able or ready to confront him. It was only the Air Force which confronted him. Everyone else just let him tootle up unopposed from Rostov towards Moscow. He was halfway there. And he pulls out at the last moment, or, you know, halfway to Moscow. And that was it. He was signing his own death warrant.
There was, as there usually is, a lag. Putin likes to strike at a time of his own choosing. Prigozhin was allowed to leave the country. He spent time with old comrades in southern Belarus. He flew to Africa on a whistle-stop tour of Wagner Group outposts there. And then he received an invitation from the Ministry of Defense in Moscow, which he accepted. Considering the scorn that he'd heaped on the ministry in public, the meeting was said to be cordial. It was billed as a burying of hatchets. Soon after taking off in his private jet to return to Belarus, he was blown out of the sky by a surface-to-air missile. Prigozhin had become a household name and then a threat. In all Russia's 11 time zones, the same could be said of only one other living person. In the final episode of Putin's murders, the full Stalin. This episode was reported by me, Giles Whittell. The producers were Matt Russell and Katie Gunning. The sound design was by Dominic DeLaghi, with artwork by John Hill. The editor was Jasper Corbett.
Tortoise.
That's a sort of freedom, like an intrinsic knowledge, like you are part ocean, ocean is part you. You have salt water in your body. You are part of this.
Oceans, life underwater. A new podcast all about the oceans and the mind-blowing life within them.
Subscribe now to Oceans, Life Underwater on your favorite podcast app.